I'm Chris Boyd. Up next on Think, why juries don't work like they're supposed to and whether it's possible to fix a broken system. We'll spend this hour with Drury Sherrod, a social psychologist who specializes in jury research. Sherrod says some of the instructions judges give jurors, like not making up their minds until they've heard all the evidence, run counter to what we know about the way humans think, which is to say, almost impossible to fully comply with. We'll talk about how group dynamics can shape jury behavior and about ideas for reducing the effect of the biases that jurors and judges bring with them into the courtroom. Our conversation starts after a short break. If you think about it, serving on a jury is a strange experience. We show up to do our civic duty, weigh the evidence, and reach a verdict that could potentially affect the rest of someone's life. Yet we're not experts at this, are we? Even those of us who show up every time we're summoned for jury duty might only find ourselves impaneled a handful of times in our lives. How can we know we're doing it right? From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Drury R. Sherrod is a social psychologist and co-founder of jury research firm Mattson and Sherrod Incorporated. He has real concerns about juries' potential for failure. Some of what we're asked to consider can be complicated, legal procedures are often confusing for non-experts, and that rule about not making up our minds until we've heard all the evidence, that part sounds good, it just doesn't account for how human brains actually work. His book is called The Jury Crisis, What's Wrong with Jury Trials and How We Can Save Them. He joins us from the studios of KPCC in Pasadena, California. Drew, welcome to Think.
Thanks, Chris. I'm happy to be here.
So let's start with this. Jury trials are actually in decline as a percentage of civil and criminal cases. Why are many defendants choosing to forfeit their right to a trial by jury?
Well, let me plug in some numbers first, because it's really staggering. It turns out that of all the civil trials filed in a year today, about one half of 1% ever reach a jury. That's down from percentages as high as 20%, maybe just 20 years ago. So that's an extremely staggering figure. One half of 1% ever reach a jury in civil trials. If you look at criminal trials, it's just under 1% ever reach a jury. So a lot of people are concerned that we are essentially seeing the death of the jury, that we are seeing the vanishing jury. The jury is disappearing. And that's the hyperbolic reason for the title in the book, The Jury Crisis. So did you ask me what people are doing instead of resorting to juries?
Was well, yeah, why they're not choosing juries, why they'd rather have some other option.
Juries are not trusted. Juries are demeaned, denigrated, and ridiculed. They are seen as delivering incomprehensible verdicts and as being unable to understand evidence and as often declaring a mistrial, sending a note to the judge saying, we're stuck. And a recent example is the first Bill Cosby trial. There were two Bill Cosby trials last year. And the first one, the juries deliberated for 54 hours, which was longer than the duration of the actual trial. They deliberated 54 hours. The juries were interviewed after the fact by the New York Times. And one juror even said, we spent an entire day debating on the meaning of the word reckless, because the charge was the woman who visited his home doing something reckless that she should have known better. That was the charge. So they actually spent a day trying to figure out the meaning of reckless, and they ultimately declared a mistrial. For the last 22 hours of deliberations, no one budged. People sat, folded their arms, and closed their eyes.
So one major problem with juries is that they are asked to do things that run counter to human nature, including being instructed to withhold any judgment whatsoever until they've heard all the evidence. Why is that so hard for the average human being to do?
Because part of the answer to that comes from Daniel Kahneman, who founded behavioral economics. He wrote a book called Thinking Fast and Slow, and it was a notable book of the year in 2011 in the New York Times. He says that we evolved to do fast, intuitive, automatic, narrative thinking. We immediately tell stories when we need to make a decision. And he calls that System 1 thinking. And System 2 is a slow, analytical, objective analysis of evidence. And he says the brain basically evolved to do System 1 thinking, this rapid, intuitive, narrative-style thinking. And we only resort to System 2, which is objective analysis, when we need support for our rapid narratives. So basically, that's the notion. The brain didn't evolve to spend lots of time analyzing evidence. We evolved to jump to a conclusion. And in jury trials, it turns out that about 75% or 80% of people begin making up their mind during the opening statement. And they just use what they decide there to guide what they attend to during the cases in chief.
Wow. So we actually tend to remember the things, remember the evidence that supports the conclusion that we started to form early on. And without intending to, we forget some of the evidence that goes against it.
Nice experiments have been done where somebody will sit through a trial. This is in a mock version in a psychology experiment. They will listen to all the evidence in a trial. Then they'll be given a list of, say, 100 statements. Half supported one side, half supported the other. And they will misremember the statements, and they will claim to have heard statements that were never presented as long as it's consistent with their view. And they will claim never to have heard statements that were presented which were inconsistent with their view.
Wow. So the expectation that juries will be a group of impartial strangers is actually a pretty recent one. Will you tell us a little bit about the history of how jurors used to get the evidence they needed to render a verdict?
It's pretty fascinating. Jury actually evolved in early Anglo-Saxon settlements in England, and then they were codified by the Magna Carta in 1215. And for the first several hundred years of trial by jury, there were no witnesses, there was no evidence. It was pretty much just a gossip session. The king would send an officer to a village and deal with somebody who was accused, say, of stealing a neighbor's sheep. And they would assemble 12 men, never women, of sort of similar status, like yeomen, farmers, tradesmen, artisans. And they would be told to resolve the question. For example, did somebody named Godric steal his neighbor's sheep? And they would talk about it. They would decide, you know, maybe he did, maybe not. Somebody would say, well, seems to have changed a lot lately. And by that reasoning, they would come to decide that somebody was innocent or guilty. So for the first several hundred years of jury trial, jurors were thought to be or required to be self-informing, that the only evidence was what they knew firsthand or through gossip about a member of the village.
Wow. So Jodrick better hope to be on good terms with you when he's accused of stealing a sheep. So when did we start instead asking jurors to listen to evidence presented by attorneys?
Well, jurors came to be witness informed somewhere around the 16th century. But even at that point, the witnesses were very rudimentary. It would be another neighbor who had this to say, but they would appear before a group of random people from the courthouse, bailiffs, hangers-on, people like that. It still wasn't really witnesses and serious evidence didn't happen until about the close of the 19th century. And even then, trials were very brief. Evidence would be presented in about half an hour. Juries would retire to deliberate, take about 15 minutes, and come back and reach a verdict. And then into the 20th century, trials were still pretty brief until laws of discovery changed and a lot more evidence became admissible. And then jurors had a much bigger job that may have exceeded the capacity of the brain at that point.
Yeah, I mean, presumably we changed the way we did things because we wanted to do it better. Is there evidence that juries are more likely to get the verdict right with the way that evidence is presented today?
No, the contrary. if we go back to the thinking fast and slow model and we evolved to tell stories, not to do the rational analysis of evidence, we basically just use the evidence that we'll sit through 3 months of a trial and use the evidence that we heard to bolster the position we arrived at early on.
Wow. Okay. What does it mean to be guaranteed a jury of one's peers? How peer-like do they have to be in order to count?
You know, you can wonder, is it possible in today's America with class stratified, economically extreme differences in education? It's pretty hard to assemble a jury of one's peers. Plus, there are lots of problems involved. I just read a very recent article that was just published, which says that when jury summons are sent out, about 15% of them are never received. They're considered undeliverable. And often it's that people who are poorer move often, they don't keep the same addresses, the addresses aren't changed with the post office, so they never get the summons, the jury summons. If you have 15% of the people who never get a summons, another 10 to 15% don't respond. So it turns out that under 75% of the summons sent out ever produce an actual response or a face at a jury panel.
I'm always surprised that people who have never actually served on a jury are convinced that they never want to serve on a jury. Why do people dread jury duty so much?
They truly do dread it. I mean, partly it's not pleasant to be a juror. You go in, you sit for a long time, you're in an unpleasant, often sterile surroundings. You don't know what you're doing. Maybe you're asked questions. It's just not pleasant. But I think it's the foundation of democracy. Even though it's unpleasant, the trial, guaranteed a trial by jury is in the Sixth and Seventh Amendment of the U.S. Constitution. It's basically the building blocks of democracy. It's when the people come together to speak truth to power. When they can, as you said in your introduction, they can tell a corporation, you know, you made a defective product. You owe this injured person $50 million. They can tell the state, this person shouldn't be accused. This person shouldn't be tried. You should allow this person to go free.
So juries are asked not to discuss anything about the case, even with one another, even privately, until it's time to deliberate. Why do you say that we might as well just change that requirement?
Well, one interesting thing here is that jury deliberations are sacrosanct. No one knows what goes on. There's no court, no one to transcribe what was said. They don't ever tell the jury why they tell the judge why they reached the verdict they reached. However, in my work as a jury consultant, I was often hired to conduct post-trial jury interviews where I would telephone at least half of the jurors or more and spend up to 2 hours with them and talk. And most of the jurors really want to ventilate. They want to explain. They want to justify their decisions. They're happy to spend 2 hours on the phone explaining what they made of the evidence, what others on the jury thought of the evidence, how they reached the verdict they reached. But just to add one point here, deliberations aren't the way the judges think they should be. It's not the case the jurors sit down and then they all reason together and they reach a unanimous verdict. What invariably happens is when jurors come in and sit down, they go around the table and each person says guilty or innocent, or in a civil trial, liable or not liable. And then many of them hold to it. It turns out lots of research says that the first verdict reached in deliberations is always the winning verdict. The minority almost always loses, either because they cave in out of conformity or they become convinced of the other side's evidence by so much talk.
So why waste everybody's time? Asking these 12 people to talk very carefully and seriously consider the evidence that's been presented to them.
Well, that involves what are the alternatives? The alternatives, in a criminal trial, the alternative is plea bargaining, where you agree to a lesser offense in order to have a lighter sentence, because you don't trust juries. In a civil trial, it's the resorting to experts who have the same biases. I think you mentioned that yourself, that experts bring biases to a resolution. And it could be a judge. Judges have biases. It could be a mediator. Mediators have biases. It could be an arbitrator in binding arbitration. I have a good friend who's an arbitrator, and he says he always tries to figure out the story before he begins to decide which side should win in binding arbitration. So he himself admits that he begins with a story. So I guess my answer to the question is, why do we have 12 jurors and why are they better than the experts? Because the experts are all biased in their way. And I would rather spread the bias around 12 people than vest it in one person.
How often do judges, I guess privately, because they wouldn't say so publicly, either disagree or agree with jury verdicts?
A lot of research there, and it's one of the big questions in jury research. Most of the research finds that judges say they agree with jury verdicts. Judges seem to want to be on the same side as juries. Now, we don't know why that's the case. Is that because the judges share the same biases and the judges themselves may reach a verdict early in the trial? We really don't know how judges think, except in my jury consulting firm. We have sometimes been hired to help a client prepare for a bench trial, which is when a judge hears evidence and makes a decision. So to prepare for those, we've recruited panels of judges, say 12 retired judges. They will get a dense packet of information, and they end up also splitting among themselves.
My guest is Drury R. Sherrod, co-founder of the jury research firm Mattson & Sherrod Incorporated. His new book is The Jury Crisis: What's Wrong with Jury Trials and How We Can Save Them. You can join our conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372. We'll be back in 2 minutes. We'll be right back. This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with social psychologist Drury R. Sherrod, co-founder of the jury research firm Mattson & Sherrod Incorporated. His book is The Jury Crisis: What's Wrong with Jury Trials and How We Can Save Them. You can join our conversation at 1-800-933-5372, or you can find us on Twitter at KERATHINK. Okay, Drew, we really need to understand group dynamics in order to understand what's happening with juries. A jury starts out as 12 strangers, typically 12 strangers who have never met one another. But the moment they become a jury, they are a group, and that's going to affect their behavior. Tell us about that.
They really do become a very unusual group. They, as you said, they enter the courtroom knowing, not knowing each other at all. They have no idea why they're there. From the outset, they have little badges, so they sort of have special identifiers. They go everywhere as a group. They enter the courtroom, and the judge and all the audience and the jurors and the attorneys stand up. They eat lunches together because they can't talk about the trial. They talk about their lives and their families and their children and their hobbies. They gradually become forged into a really tight-knit group because they have to make a decision, and it's a decision that may involve life or death or imprisonment or millions of dollars. So the task becomes an extremely important task for them. So over the time of the trial, they enter from not knowing each other at all to knowing all about each other's families and going through the stress of hearing complicated information they can't talk about with each other and then trying to recall it during deliberations and do it respectfully. And groups are subject. There's two terms here that ought to be introduced. Once they start deliberate, the losing side is subject to informational pressures and normative pressure. So information is just the fact that the majority is going to dump a lot more facts than the minority can. And the normative is, once the jury is about half and half, or say, many juries can declare a 9-3 verdict and say 9 out of 12 is a victory. So once it gets close to 7 or 8, jurors are motivated from all the pressure, the normative pressure, should just cave in and come up with a reason like, over lunch I thought more about it and now I agree with you.
And you think at least part of that is because one is part of this little group and doesn't want to disappoint everybody else who really wants to get home in time for dinner.
Well, yeah, there's two issues there. One, you're part of the group and you don't want to disappoint the others. And the second explanation is, as you said, it's Friday and it's 3 p.m. and you don't want to come back on Monday. So you decide, I see what you're saying. Now I agree with you. And when we conduct post-trial jury interviews, that's not at all unusual. In almost any jury, there's somebody who at the last minute changes. And if I talk to them long enough, they'll trust me enough to say, I really just wanted to go home.
How influential is the foreman of the jury on the verdict that is reached?
The interesting thing there is how a foreman is conducted. There's a lot of research that, and here it's just it's social norms. A tall, white male, if he's seated at the head of the table, will almost automatically be chosen foreperson. I have a good friend who doubted my social science predictions here, and he was on a jury trial. So I told him, well, if you rush to get to the jury room and you sit at the head of the table, and he was a tall, white, professional male, I said, you'll be elected foreperson. And he was within a couple of minutes.
So how does the foreperson just gets one vote like everybody else? Does that person's influence matter more than everybody else's?
Only when they help clarify issues. Often forepersons don't do that. Often when we've run these mock trials and I observe them on one-way mirrors or on closed-circuit TV, often another person sort of takes over the foreperson's job because the foreperson hasn't really known what to do. They just happen to be maybe when the jurors sit down, somebody says, well, we need to elect a foreperson, and somebody will say, why not you? And that's often all the thought that goes into selecting a foreperson. So they don't necessarily have influence. Although lawyers distrust a highly professional and articulate and charismatic person, because lawyers will think that person will be elected either the actual foreperson or will take over the jury, and the jurors are going to go with him. He or she will run the show, and they don't want to risk that happening.
So you mentioned the first Cosby trial getting hung up on this question of what reckless meant in terms of reckless endangerment. That seems like the sort of term that ought to be defined for a jury.
Well, the judge's instructions are very obtuse. And I have one paragraph here that I'd like to read you. This is in a civil trial where maybe somebody, a manufacturer of a vehicle, has been sued. Mm-hmm. And so here's the jury charge. A product is unreasonably dangerous because of its design if it fails to perform as safely as an ordinary consumer would expect when used as intended or in a manner reasonably foreseeable by the manufacturer. So there are lots of terms there that are subjective. What's unreasonable? What's unreasonably dangerous? Who is an ordinary consumer? What is reasonably foreseeable? If you think of, there are a lot of trials about SUV, sport utility vehicles, that ride high mm-hmm. and high off the road, which makes them a little more subject to, if they're not handled right, to a trip, roll over, and be in a roof crush case. But in fact, so in the commercials you see about SUVs, all these very dramatic situations where you drive up 45 degree steep hills, you crash through water and over boulders, you drive to a precipice and suddenly come to a stop. So that's the image people have of the coolness of having an SUV or the utility of having a place large enough for kids and groceries and pets and all that. But the reality of how it's used isn't portrayed in those TV commercials. And so sometimes there's a little note in the visor that says this is not handled like an ordinary vehicle. But people don't see that and don't read it. And sometimes it's buried in the instructor's manual. So they have a different notion of what's actually going on than they drive differently than the commercial TV drivers are shown.
All right, let's go to the phones now. Our number 1-800-933-5372. We have Anna on the line in Cypress, Texas. Hi, Anna.
Hi.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
I had experience with a jury trial, and the judge was behind in her docket, and she allowed such undue pressure on the jury because she wanted them to hurry up and deliberate. So the jury would show up at 8 o'clock in the morning, and they probably hadn't eaten since 6:30 if they ate breakfast, and she wouldn't break for lunch until 2:30 or 3 in the afternoon. And this happened 2 or 3 days in a row, and the jury was not 12 angry men. They were 12 hungry men. I believe that it thoroughly affected their deliberations and that, you know, like the gentleman said, that they, for the sake of unity,
yeah,
let's get this over with, because they could expect the same thing. And she wanted to hurry up. It was Friday morning when they left for deliberation, and she wanted to hurry up and get the verdict so she could select her next jury for the next trial.
You know, your point is interesting, because in the history of trial by jury, for several hundred years, jurors were not allowed to try to deliberate until they were not allowed to eat or drink until they completed deliberations and arrived at a verdict. And this was even this is the reason for a famous English poet, Alexander Pope, who wrote in 1714, his line is, "Wretches hang that jurymen may dine." So these accused people they're given verdicts of hanging because the juries want to get to their dinner. Wretches hang that jurymen may dine.
So one of the things that you suggest is that jurors be instructed to go around the table in the deliberation room before anybody tries to convince anybody else of anything. Everybody go around and say, this is what I think, either guilty or innocent, liable or not liable. How is that different from what actually happens in jury deliberations?
What actually happens is almost something like that. Each juror will say liable or not liable. What I was really proposing is that if we view jury trials as storytelling opportunities and we view jurors as storytellers, then when these people sit down, they each are going to have a personal story, and they're going to have a reason for talking about that personal story because it's something that happened in their own lives. So my suggestion was that we advise jurors actually that in deliberations, you should go around and each person tell what you're thinking about, how you're leaning and why you're leaning that way, and how you came up with that decision. So that each person essentially is required to tell their story and how they arrived at the story. And then to ask people to even subject their own stories to verification, asking other people what they think and seeking other people's idea why they arrived at the story they arrived at.
So in jury selections here in Texas, which we call voir dire here in Texas,
I know. It's even a verb. I'm on voir dire my jury.
Right, exactly. It appears that attorneys are very carefully striking people because they think they know how a particular juror is going to decide before that juror has even heard any of the evidence whatsoever in the case. How predictable are potential jurors as people who will ultimately vote?
It's one of the fundamental questions in jury research. And the general finding is that general dispositions like education, income, employment, those kinds of factors seldom predict a verdict, despite what lawyers think. What predicts a verdict is a juror's behavior, lifestyles, values, and attitudes on issues very, very close to the issue that will be involved in the trial. So if you know that in advance, what you want to try to do is, and to do this, you need to get very extensive pre-trial jury questionnaires. So you'll know what characteristics and lifestyles jurors will bring to the courtroom that will reliably predict their verdict. And this sounds very much like a Dr. Bull episode, but in Dr. Bull, it's so much more elaborate with so much computer information and takes days and hundreds of thousands or millions of dollars that it's not. While in principle it's like a Dr. Bull episode, in reality it's much more low-key.
Hmm. All right. Let's go next on the phone to Tonda in Dallas. Hi, Tonda.
Hi. I have been on a jury before. It was a civil trial. And was wondering, I was told that we could not, and I don't remember if I was told this by the judge or by the lawyers, but one of those told me that we could not take any notes during the trial. And I thought that was a ridiculous rule. Was wondering if that's normal and why is that?
I agree with you that it's ridiculous. And I'll tell you that it's normal. I think judges think that once people take notes, they become distracted from focusing on the evidence that's being presented. And a few courtrooms do allow jurors to take notes, but most of them don't. And in a related question, too, is why can't jurors ask questions? If something is unclear, wouldn't it make sense to allow jurors to send a note to the judge and say, you know, would you please ask the witness to address that point again? Most judges don't allow note-taking. Now, in some very, very modern courtrooms where all the jurors have a computer right in front of them, they can actually send a note to the judge and say, would you please have the witness go over this again? And the judge can either decide yes or no. He'll call the lawyers to his bench, and he'll say, a juror would like this witness to go over this point again. Is that okay? And then the attorneys will agree or not agree. But you're right. It's I've always thought it amounts to picking people off the street, having them sit down for a six-month college course in physics, not telling them what they should be learning or looking for, and then giving them an exam. It almost makes no sense at all.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Sometimes a particular defendant might have an attorney who is annoying or bending rules or sort of not doing things the way the judge likes, and the judge might reprimand that attorney without necessarily intending to give someone the impression that the judge favors or disfavors one side or the other. Do judges' instructions and corrections to attorneys on either side tend to prejudice juries?
Well, this is close to that dramatic moment in TV when a witness is speaking and the other side's attorney jumps up and says object, and then the judge says overruled.
Mm-hmm.
I think jurors will notice which side the judge seems to be overruling questions in favor of. So I think you're right. Jurors, it's not common, but I think jurors may think that the judge does seem to be favoring one side in the rulings he gives, or especially when during jury selection, when an attorney would want to strike a potential juror for cause, meaning that the voir dire or the voir dire questions had revealed like a deep-seated bias. So this attorney asked the judge to strike this person for cause, and the judge can agree or disagree. So at that point, the judge really steps into manipulating the trial by either not allowing a side to strike a juror who appears to be biased. And it's often done in an interesting way. Somebody will say they've really made up their mind, they just don't think they'd be a very good juror. And the judge will say something like, do you mean you would ignore my instructions and not keep your mind open till you've heard all the evidence? And they would say, oh, no, sir, of course not, no, sir. So then he decides they can be seated.
Hmm. It's a little bit of a when did you stop beating your wife question.
It is that.
Hmm. At what point, according to your evidence, your research as a jury researcher, at what point do most people who are seated on a jury decide whether someone is guilty or innocent, liable or not liable?
Well, the issue, we addressed a little bit of this earlier. I do think it's the case that they actually make these decisions, not firm ironclad, but they tend to start leaning toward one side or the other very early during the opening statements. Because once they relate it to their own life, once they evoke what's called a stored script, you know, a little narrative from their own life that's somewhat like the trial, once they reach that point, they're making up their minds. And there's a very nice model of research called the story model of jury decision making, where they filmed and reenacted a murder trial in Boston, and then had juror-qualified subjects sit through this reenacted murder trial. And the first thing people started doing was telling a story. And it turns out that almost half of what was discussed in deliberations was never mentioned in trial. It's just events from a person's own life. And that different kinds of people tell different stories. And that once they start telling a story, then that predicts their verdict.
Hmm. All right. Let's go back to the phones. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. We have Tucker on the line in Austin. Hi, Tucker.
Hey. My question is, I'm almost 60, and I was just on my first jury trial, and what the gentleman was talking about in terms of jurors going into deliberate and sitting down and saying guilty, not guilty right off the bat, that's what happened. I was just surprised to hear that, because that's what I experienced. And so my question is, how often do, in his experience, do people actually, the jurors actually deliberate? How often do they, I mean, we talk through stuff afterwards, but I'm just curious
right.
how often it happens that they actually do, and yeah.
All right, that's a great question. We'll get an answer after this break with my guest, Drury R. Sherrod. He is co-founder of the jury research firm Mattson and Sherrod and author of The Jury Crisis, What's Wrong with Jury Trials and How We Can Save Them. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372. Listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with social psychologist Drury R. Sherrod, co-founder of the jury research firm Mattson and Sherrod. His book is The Jury Crisis, What's Wrong with Jury Trials and How We Can Save Them. Before the break, Drew, we heard from Tucker, who had the experience of walking into deliberations and finding that many of his fellow jurors had made their minds up, and he wanted to know if that's typical.
Yeah, that is typical. Also, I think the statistic on jury deliberations are that the average deliberation is just 3 hours. So it's unusual that jurors, in fact, you might think if they made their minds up, then it should expedite the trial. What happens is when they made up their minds and they're defiantly split, like in the Bill Cosby trial we referred to earlier, I think there were four jurors who were holdouts, who just wouldn't change their mind. And the juror who was interviewed by the New York Times and was printed in the paper said that after the first, 30 hours, there were another 22 hours when no one changed their mind at all. Hmm. So that's when they finally declared a mistrial.
So it's really hard to know what to do about holdouts, because sometimes people hold out because they really are right and everybody else has it wrong, and they sort of have this insight that others don't share. Sometimes people are just wrong, and sometimes it's really impossible to say which side is right. So is the group dynamic that pressures people to sort of go along with the majority necessarily a bad thing for justice?
I think the really interesting question there is, who is right? Is there a right side and a wrong side? Are there just two different sides? Using the example of auto defect cases that I've been using, we did enough of those that we could amalgamate all of our data on 10 years of trials involving allegations against automakers. And it turns out that plaintiff jurors have fundamentally different views of the issue than defense jurors. For example, as simple as appraising risk, what's the risk of a vehicle? If you make it real simple and just sort of make a decision based on gender and ethnicity, it turns out that sort of well-off older white men are the kind of people who protect themselves pretty well from things hurting them in society. So they think, in an accident case, they think, you know, that person should have taken better care of themselves. They shouldn't have taken that risky maneuver. I wouldn't have done that, so I think that person's guilty. On the far end, if you have young, poor, minority females who are exactly the opposites of the old rich white guys, you know, they're kind of people who have been rolled over, bowled over by life. Lots of things have hurt them. So they appraise risk differently. They expect the vehicle to be much safer. They expect the instructions to be much clearer. They expect engineers to have done much better testing. So it's the interesting question under those circumstances is, so who's right? Is there a right? Is it just risk is a perceived value?
How does that play into the likelihood of juries awarding large damages?
Yeah, we actually did research on that. It turns out that high damage awarders are the same as, for example, in an auto case. The plaintiffs are the ones who think the vehicle is risky. The auto manufacturer should be punished and maybe given punitive damages. So the people who give damages are the ones who are most skeptical, most afraid, most worrisome. And then the people who give high damages are super versions of those people. For example, in a car case, if somebody has been injured or worries about injury or has a loved one who was injured or worries about harm in life or worries about protecting themselves from harm, people who are worriers or have experienced unpleasant circumstances are more likely to favor a minority who says, I want better protection, I want better engineering, I want better tests.
You say that attorneys on either side should have fewer peremptory strikes of potential jurors. Why?
I think if you want a jury of one's peers, you don't want to remove the extremes. You don't want to remove the extremes of education. Like defense lawyers often think, I want an educated juror who can understand all the engineering concepts here. Whereas the defense lawyer version of what a plaintiff lawyer wants is somebody who's going to empathize with the injured person and want to offer damages and compensation.
Hmm. All right. 1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also find us on Twitter at KERA Think. We have Patty on the line in Kyle, Texas. Hi, Patty.
Hi there.
Hello.
My question is, I just sat on a jury selection this past week. I was not chosen, which got me thinking about what plays into the selection and dismissing of certain potential jurors. It happened to be a murder trial, and the only thing that I could attribute to my disqualification was that it appears I'm a resident of the same community as the accused. So in general, what plays into the selection of a juror for a particular trial?
Wait, before we let you go, Patty, were you far down on the list of you know, like, was there a chronological order in which people were placed as you walked in for jury selection?
No, I was at the top of the list.
Okay.
And in fact, I had fellow participants comment that they were certain I was going to get picked, and then I didn't make the cut, which was fine, but it just made me curious.
Drew, can you make any guesses?
They might have thought that you seemed too sure of yourself. They might have thought that you might be a leader. They might have done, if they did more extensive voir dire questioning, they would have or may have asked you about your experience and your how you felt about people who were guilty. Like many people, even friends have told me that when they hear that somebody is accused of something, they think guilty, because why would that person be in a situation where they could even have gotten accused of something? So there are lots of reasons. It might have been the way you answered questions. It might be that they thought you were, you know, depending on your education versus the others, that you might be a leader, that they weren't sure in what direction you would lead the jury.
Is there any evidence that juries are swayed by the severity of the charges? In other words, are people more likely to be able to keep an open mind, answering a question about whether someone stole a car as compared with hearing that someone is accused of murder or child molestation or that sort of thing?
Oh, let's see. Some related issues are in a murder trial, which is when jurors have to be, especially a state with a death sentence, mm-hmm. when jurors have to be death qualified, that means Do they agree they could award the death penalty? They often tend to have many other more conservative and more authoritarian attitudes. So one of the problems with death-qualifying jurors is that they bring a cluster of attitudes about punishment and liability and along with them. And it could bias the trial.
Okay, let's speak now with Yvette in Round Rock. Hi, Yvette, Round Rock, Texas.
Hi, thanks so much for having this program. I'm learning so much, and it's been very enjoyable and also scary. Anyway, my question is just imagining working with, you know, a group of random people and just remembering, like, college group projects and things like that. I'm just curious, is there ever a situation where two jurors just don't see eye to eye or have personality clashes and just really don't get along and sort of just by default argue and disagree with each other? And how does that affect the outcome? And also, how is that dealt with?
Thanks for calling.
I think it happens often. In our post-trial jury interviews, we often hear that some jurors just became so upset with the group that they would just yell, "Shut up." And they would just, in one case, this man, it involved a cosmetic drug. And the man believed he had had a similar illness caused by a similar drug. So he wouldn't even listen to people who wanted to talk about other alternative causes. And he would, in fact, according to the people I talked to on the phone, he would scream and yell and just turn his back to them and leave the room. And they were having so much time, trouble dealing with him that they sent the judge a note and said, "There's this one uncooperative juror." So the judge excused that person and got somebody else.
How can we get more people to show up when they receive a jury summons?
Some states are more punitive than others. For example, some states, if you're called over for a traffic violation, the computer will show that you also ignored a jury summons. And the police may be authorized, say, if you've ignored three jury summons, to take you in and arrest you, not only for the traffic violation, but for having ignored a jury summons. Now, most states aren't that punitive. The better way is just to make it very simple. In California, you can call in each morning for, I think, maybe 7 days, and you get an automatic message which says you're needed or not needed to show up that day. So it's, and most of the time, I've gone through this several times, most of the time you're not required to show up, probably once again because there are so few trials.
And you also say that it might be a good idea to widen the potential jury panel. So in other words, don't just draw from voter registration lists.
Yeah. Many states just have voter registration lists. Other states have several different lists: voter registration, auto driver's license, if you receive state aid for various projects, then you're in a much broader list, and the list is more representative. You still had that problem, though, that I talked about people who don't receive summons and who don't respond to summons. And it turns out that minorities are less likely both to receive and to respond. Partly it's because of the compensation that they have employers who don't compensate for days off at work. So it would essentially be, I think jurors get paid so little, $15 to $25 a day in most states. So if you took a day off from work, you'd earn something far less than your hourly, even say at a fast food restaurant.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Yeah, I can completely understand this sense that everybody should do their civic duty. On the other hand, if I'm the defendant, I don't know that I want a juror there who absolutely doesn't want to be there and has been compelled to show up.
Well, often that'll be one of the reasons that an attorney will use a peremptory strike where they can just strike somebody for whatever reason, because they think, I just don't want an angry juror on here. And they may have tried to get the juror off for cause, and the judge will not have excused the juror for cause. So the juror is left on there being grumpy, and one side or the other will just strike the juror, get a peremptory strike.
All right. 1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go on the phone to Annie in Houston. Hi, Annie.
Hi. Thank you for this program today. Thank you for having me on. my question comes from a few years ago. I was with a coworker, and we were talking about jury duty, and they had mentioned that there was something, and I don't know if I'm using the right terminology here, but something in the judicial code that said judges have the discretion, it's just not talked about very often, that they can actually disagree with a verdict that's rendered if they, completely at their discretion. They just don't do it very often. And then my first question is that true? And second, to follow up, if that is true and you're aware of that, the person that had told me this said that's almost a dead giveaway that you won't be selected because essentially, you know, people selecting juries say, you know, no. Since this person knows this is a possibility, they're not going to work out. So I have two questions in both, you know, are they true and what are the repercussions of that?
Thanks for calling.
The first question is that in the Seventh Amendment, jurors are referred to as triers of fact, and it says that facts determined by a jury cannot be changed by any court in the U.S. That's fact. Where judges come in is trying to decide if the law has been violated, if jurors have just ignored the law and just arrived at, say, jury nullification. So then the judges may overrule or require a retrial. And your second question?
Let's make sure that we get it right. Annie, what was your second question? That you thought if people were aware of this, they wouldn't get selected because they seemed to know too much?
Yeah, something along those lines.
Any sense that a very well-informed person is struck from a jury?
Not for being informed. That's where one of the attorneys might use a peremptory strike because they think this person, for example, sort of a car buff. You wouldn't an auto attorney wouldn't want a car buff thinking that he knows too much about car engineering because they would think, I just don't know where this guy's going to take the jury.
Drew, what happens when a judge is, you know, selected to do his or her civic duty and act as a juror? What do we know about their behavior as jurors?
I don't know that many judges are selected as jurors. I think that would be pretty rare. I think not even a lot of attorneys don't get selected as jurors.
Because they're assumed to have too much knowledge?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I was in a recent jury selection about 5 years ago. I mean, it's in the jury pool. And they asked, I told them what I did as a living, and the judge let me stay. And then I was as an alternate, and one of the attorneys went down the row and asked each alternate to say, do you promise me you'll keep an open mind and not make up your mind till you've heard all the evidence? And I sort of gave that head tilted back and forth like, you know, I don't know. And she said, what does that mean? And I said, well, most of the evidence shows that, most of the research shows that jurors make up their mind early on and then just use that to guide what they attend to. And at that point, she threw up her arm, faced the jury, and said, ignore everything that man's telling you. Just ignore everything he's saying. Then she sat down and said, we thank and excuse Mr. Sherrod.
Were you trying to get out of jury service?
No, I thought it'd be good juice for a talk like this.
And you were just trying to be honest about what you sincerely believe.
Yeah.
Drury R. Sherrod is a social psychologist, and he is co-founder of the jury research firm Mattson and Sherrod. His book is called The Jury Crisis, What's Wrong with Jury Trials and How We Can Save Them. Drew, it's been a really interesting conversation. Thanks so much for making time to speak with us.
I enjoyed it so much, too. Thank you.
You can follow us on Facebook and on Twitter. Our handle is @KERAThink. Subscribe to our podcast using any podcast app that you're familiar with, and learn about upcoming shows at our website, think.kera.org. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.